Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Roundtree. I'm Head of Content in ExchangeWire, and I'm joined today by Kieran O'Kane, ExchangeWire CEO. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, Lindsay.
How are you doing?
I'm brilliant. Thanks
for
asking.
Had a bit of a sneezing fit there, didn't you? Is everything all right?
Am I what?
Had a bit of a sneezing fit. Is everything okay?
I'm a bit hungover today.
Ah, heavy one, was it?
No, I just can't drink anymore. COVID has made me less piss fit than usual, so...
Get some practice back in then.
I do.
Yeah.
That's what all good alcoholics say, isn't it? Like,
well, quite. Anyway, I'm delighted to be joined by our special guest today, who is Alex Khan, Group MD International at Unruly Group. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Lindsay. Good to see you again. Hi, Kieran. I think you're not the only one that's out of practice.
How are you?
I'm very well. Very well indeed, thanks. Not a hungover, because I was staying in to watch the football last night, but I do agree that... We need to get our socialising legs back.
Yeah.
COVID has done us no favours in that area.
Yeah, it's terrible. Destroyed the country's drinking capabilities, which is sad.
It really has. It's an embarrassment.
I'm sure once the doors are open and we can go inside again, those drinking legs will come back very quickly.
Well, we've only got 3 days to wait, so bring
the
on.
Countdown is on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, enough chat about alcohol. on to... our first story, which is the news about Verizon having agreed to sell its media unit, made up of obviously AOL, Yahoo, as well as the likes of TechCrunch, Yahoo Finance and Engadget, to private equity firm Apollo Global Management for $5 billion. It's a 90-10 split between Apollo and Verizon, and the new business will operate under the Yahoo brand. So obviously Yahoo and AOL have been on quite a journey over the past few decades. These are two of the greatest internet legacies that have been around the block and seen some things. And we've had Yahoo's Will They, Won't They with Microsoft over a number of years, back in 2006 or 2008, I think it was. The eventual kind of strange unification of Yahoo and Microsoft search engine functions. We had the Marissa Mayer years where she reformatted everything and then bought Tumblr for $1 billion. And then Verizon acquired Yahoo in 2017 for $4.5 billion. And then AOL, which is even older than Yahoo, it merged in 2001 with Time Warner to become AOL Time Warner, and then AOL was dropped and it became Time Warner, and AOL became a subsidiary of Time Warner. Then in 2009 we had Tim Armstrong named CEO of AOL, and it became an independent company. It then acquired HuffPost, which has already been divested by Verizon. They got rid of that last year and sold it to BuzzFeed. But a decade ago, AOL even joined the Yahoo Microsoft Will They, Won't They debacle. And they joined forces, a trio, to try to come against the titan that was Google. That obviously went very, very well. And finally, in 2015, Verizon bought AOL for $4.4 billion. We then had One by AOL to unify AOL's ad stack after it bought Millennial Media. We then had the coming together of AOL and Yahoo eventually as Oath. Then that became Oath Ad Platforms. And then Armstrong stepped down and Oath Ad Platforms tanked and it became Verizon Media Group. Armstrong went away to become Mr. DTC. And now here we are, 2-3 years later, Verizon gets half of what it paid for both AOL and Yahoo combined.
Lindsay, that was brilliant.
Thank you.
In that time, I competed in Rubik's Cube as well.
Amazing. Yeah. That's how epic Verizon... No,
I drank 750 mils of water.
You need to go and top that up, Alex. With the long road ahead of us, I'm afraid. But, I mean, so obviously AOL, Yahoo, they are old businesses. They are the legacies of the internet, to the legacies as we know them. And it feels like Verizon... tried and failed to make a go of media, and they're pulling away from media to focus on their more internet provider businesses. Do you think that's what they... do you think they tried? Do you think they just decided that internet's where they're going and media isn't for them? Kind of where do you think... I've got two main threads of questions here, basically. So one is kind of if you're surprised by what Verizon have done, and you know why they couldn't make it work Do you see the likes of AT&T and Comcast going the same way and saying that media just isn't for them? But then the other sort of thread is the M&A scene more generally, which I think this sheds fascinating light into. Actually, Terry Kawaja wrote in Ad Exchange a couple of days ago that he sees we will have the mother of all M&A booms over the next 18 months. We've now got Mr. Ad, the ad tech ETF. We've got a potential deluge of public mad tech companies. You know, is it a really fascinating time financially to be in ad tech and martech? So I want to kind of kick off with the hear from you what your thoughts are on Verizon specifically and what will happen to the new Yahoo brand under its new banner under Apollo, and what this means for kind of M&A and what we're seeing for M&A more generally. Kieran, I'm going to start with you.
Lots of questions there. Am I surprised with this? No, I'm not. I think that Verizon had great aspirations to kind of like, you know, marry their first party data, telco data, with a media property empire, a sprawling media empire, Lindsay, as you eloquently described it there. Am I surprised that they got rid of the asset? No, because it's a great business. Verizon is a bloody monopoly in telcos and it has a fantastic recurring revenue and it's got all in 5G, and this company's been written down in terms of value. And when I think they bought the combined AOL, Yahoo, melange of products for $9 billion. So they've written it down already. So along comes a private equity firm and says, we'll take it off your hands $4 or $5 billion. And I think the private equity firm have got a steal because there's some really, really good pieces in that sort of package. You know, Yahoo Finance, Yahoo Mail, and some of the actual individual products themselves, like the sort of like media properties, which I think will be sold off first. I think they'll probably end up selling quite a lot of this part of this business for considerable amounts of money. I think Yahoo Finance is another interesting one.
Yeah.
I think together they're actually, it's a mess, but actually apart it could be very valuable, the assets in there. So in terms of the M&A question, I think that it signals that, again, that private equity is very, very interested in ad tech, the media business, and some of ad tech assets as well, because obviously there's quite a lot of ad tech assets baked into that. I don't know what's going to happen to that. But my sense is that there's just too many disparate pieces that they will start picking out some pieces out of it. I mean, like, if you think about Yahoo Mail still has 100 or 200 million people using it, that's like a first-party data solution there in a post-cookie world. Like, that's worth something. That's worth a lot of money. So I think that it's sad because actually I think they were turning the corner a little bit, but Verizon just doesn't have the patience. So they wanted to offload the asset, make some money back, and go all in 5G. That's what they're focusing. So pure play telco. But it does say something about telco companies buying ad tech. Like, you know what I mean? It's been a bit of a...
It's not been smooth sailing, has it?
It hasn't been a great success, no.
No.
I mean, you've got, obviously, AT&T, is it Comcast, sorry, that owns Freewheel and Beeswax. And
yeah,
then AT&T owns
Xander.
Xander. There's talk about Xander being spun out. Everybody's talking about that one.
I think that is up for sale. Yeah.
And then obviously you've got our friends over in Singapore, Singtel, that own a bunch of different assets. So what happens to them? Will that be spun off as a company?
Lots
as well?
Of rumors going around with Amobee and what's happening with that.
Yeah, so the telco ad tech relationship has been kind of a patchy one. And maybe this is a debt now to any future engagement around that. Like,
maybe it is. I mean, a few years ago, all we talked about was the opportunity that existed with telcos and ad tech. And we saw a massive data play going on there and the opportunity they have with their reach and their assets and their wealth to be able to do something with ad tech. And now it feels like it's going the other way. Alex, I'm fascinated what your thoughts are on this. Did you see this coming from Verizon? You are an ex-Oath man yourself, of course. So,
I've got the triumvirate. I'm ex-AOL. I'm ex-Yahoo, ex-AOL, ex-Oath, ex-Verizon. So I've got all four Cumberland.
Do you get like a lifetime watch or something for that?
I got a body warmer.
Right, nice.
Am I surprised by it? No. Do I think it's a short-term or long-term play? I would question it. Bearing in mind Verizon's gone all in on 5G. And the reality of 5G means that consumers are going to be taking in on board a lot more content at a faster rate with greater clarity, in a more probably using more mobile solutions to tablets and phones. You would have thought the convergence of video and 5G makes it a strong play to stay in that business. However, I think the writing was really on the wall when Loan McAdam stepped down from Verizon. He was the main driving force behind it. The loss of Tim Armstrong as the figurehead, I think, is a massive loss for the business in terms of what it was, what it was trying to achieve, what its strategy was, what its direction was. And I think that Verizon have tried to cherry pick in selling some assets off. The HuffPost sale to BuzzFeed. I mean, HuffPost was one of the crown jewels in our portfolio, and to sell that off, I think, was an indicator to the market. And to Kieran's point, given the level of interest at the moment in and around ad tech companies, and with IPOs that have happened and are happening, you've only got to look at the merger of Magnite and SpotX, and you look at the performance of PubMatic since it floated. There's a lot of interest there. So I think Apollo have looked at this as an opportunity where they can pick up an asset for around $4.5 billion, and it, in its constituent parts, they could probably make considerably more than that. And the interesting thing will be is if that isn't on the horizon for them, how are they going to maintain that relationship with Verizon for access to the first party data? Because that only exists really in the US. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is a breakup of the business from a territory point of view, in that the international business is a pure play media business with no real data connection or asset connection to Verizon. Whereas the US, there's still, from the media business and the data from Verizon, there's still a strong connection there. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there, because the assets that have gone in terms of Tumblr and Yahoo Answers, they're folded. So really, it's what do Apollo think the total sum they can achieve with the constituent parts? And I think that's probably the play that we're going to see.
But you would think that there's not a lot left, right?
Well, if you think about the numbers and the reputation, Yahoo Finance is a very solid independent. I mean, that's a whole media business there on its own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very true.
And if you look at the email business, yes, you've got a very large email business there. One of the reasons why when I was at AOL and we made the decision to go after Yahoo was that level of data that was associated with the email business. Never really transpired to be the real driving force, which of course has limited the media growth. And yes, in the last 6 to 12 months, they have turned the corner as a media business, but you still look at the constituent parts. Yahoo Mail is a valuable asset. Yahoo Finance is a valuable asset. AOL is a media business in the US and internationally, still valuable assets. The great question is what happens with the Microsoft media business as well? Whilst there's a long-term partnership there.
That, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a long-term partnership there. But again, if you look at Microsoft's play in the media world in terms of the acquisition of LinkedIn and some of the other purchases they've made, which in the terms of ad tech is something around 20, 25 companies over the last 2-3 years, who knows what they've got planned for the long term. So when you get companies like Apollo involved, they are acutely aware running an ad tech business, as we all are, is cash heavy. You've got consistent R&D, you've got consistent upgrades, you've got to have round the clock service support levels. And that just wasn't playing into Verizon's end game. With Ericsson, the new CEO, he's all about 5G and he's all in on being a telco. It takes somebody like a strong personality like a Tim Armstrong to actually harness that drive in 5G and say, look, we can combine this with the media business and we then go to the next level, because the consumption levels of 5G is only going to go up. That means the consumption of video content only going to go up. We are well placed as a media business to do that. If you don't have those two complementary parties within the business, it's very easy as a telco to just say, I'm going to solely focus on the telco business. Now you've got an equity firm like Apollo involved, they're going to be looking at this going, okay, we have a media business that makes good money, makes nice money. But they're a PE business. They're all about return on investment.
Exactly.
So they're going to be looking at it and saying, to Kieran's point, how much is Yahoo Mail worth?
I think it's
worth. How much is Yahoo Finance worth?
Yeah. If you think about Yahoo Finance, to your point, this is like a strong property, and it's just a strong sort of brand. You could run that as a really successful standalone.
Absolutely. But it's the number one finance app. If you really break it down, it's the number one finance monitoring app that is mass to consumer.
Yeah.
And the level of investment that goes into that product is staggering.
Right.
And you have someone who picks up that asset and makes it slightly more media ad friendly.
Yeah.
You would have a very profitable return on your investment.
And you could sell, I mean, like if I was thinking about this, Yahoo Finance could be almost like premium sales, right? You could actually have a very strong IO business that's selling CPMs at a very, very high rate.
You know, absolutely. And you look at Yahoo's native network, that is, as in native ad network, that is a hugely popular product as a standalone on its own. So when you start breaking it down to cover that $4.5 billion outlay and show a return of investment, it's not going to be that difficult for these people.
Yeah.
Or they're going to run it for a while to see how they can package it up, and maybe one of the other big media owners will come in for it. But it's a big outlay to take
it's
on.
It's a lot of trouble. Messy.
But Alex, your point is that it's a good point as well. Do you see a PE firm like Apollo actually looking at the component parts of Yahoo and AOL, of which there are many, and going, yeah, we can run all those, we can make all them profitable? Or will they do what you said with the latter, which is run them for a few years, see what works, what doesn't, and then sell them off for parts? Because it feels like that's more of a PE play than going, things work.
Yeah, I mean, look, the reality is you look at the media business as a standalone business today, and it works and it makes nice money, right? It's $1 billion a year plus in revenue, and it makes a profit. Mm. The reality is it's not necessarily in the same double digit areas that PE firms want to be in as a constituent asset. And they're probably looking at that saying, within 12 to 18 months, if we invest in certain assets, how much extra are their market value? Now, clearly the crown jewels are the AOL media business is still strong, particularly on the performance levels. You've got Yahoo Mail, Yahoo Finance. You're then looking at the technology platforms that are owned, not necessarily active, but are owned by that media asset, by the combined Verizon media asset. They have some value in terms of platforms that have been made redundant or put into legacy or into maintenance mode. So there's a path for them to polish this up, potentially sell off some of the assets and get their money back. Otherwise, it's too long. I feel it's too long a play for them to stay as a single media business and try and turn increase the value they're going to get as a single unit that they bought.
I mean, like Yahoo Finance could be packaged up with one of those media companies that's trying to go public as a SPAC. Like you could literally pile that into it, because it's actually quite an interesting asset to have as a media business, like a conglomerate. And you know, it. And then you've got the whole first party play around.
Just look at News Corp. News Corp could buy Yahoo Finance, and it gives them. I mean, they haven't got a great track record for going into digital. Think MySpace.
Wall Street Journal's done pretty well.
But Wall Street Journal's done well. Now, how would you complement that and show the growth in consumer interest, direct to consumer interest into financial products? Picking up an asset like Yahoo Finance and rebranding that.
Yeah.
There you go. That you've got a ready-made financial business there.
Murdoch has gone after CNBC, because CNBC is actually a printing machine, the business channel. Fox Business has been relatively shit. It's not a great channel. It has that mad Maria Bartiromo. She's gone batshit crazy on the whole Trump stuff. So you could give legitimacy. You could rebrand that, reposition that using Yahoo Finance as a tool.
Absolutely.
To kind of bring in that whole sort of bigger audience. I think that there's a huge – those assets on their own, look, when you start separating them out. I mean, like Yahoo Mail, right, it might – the generation using Yahoo Mail might decrease, but it's still a massive signal for first party, right? Logged in data. Huge.
But it's an access – it's a great access to a legacy audience that are now predominantly with cash disposal at their from their income. Exactly. They've got networked individuals on that Yahoo map.
Yeah.
So it's a product that can derive a huge amount of value if you were to bring it into another business and either have it as a standalone or complement it to other media assets.
What about the Trade Desk buy with all their cash by Yahoo Mail, and that's their first party signal in the US?
To be honest, you've got to look at those kind of options with the way that the market is going and the ecosystem is reacting to the deprecation of cookies and how everybody can get to still deliver ads in the right place and time. You've got to look at what produces a huge amount of first party data,
yeah,
and produces it quickly,
yeah,
and produces it on a daily or at least a weekly update cycle.
Because
so you would analyze those Yahoo Mail accounts and say, right, we have a proportion that are daily logins, proportion that are weekly, proportion that are monthly. Now you've got a very rich data set that you can then plug into a DSP,
yeah,
and execute campaigns on. So is it a wild crackpot theory? No, it's not. And clearly,
and the Trade Desk stock is down 20% this week because of this problem, right? UID, yeah, thing. I think the UID thing is going to be tough to get cross-channel. But if you imagine that you have a Yahoo Mail, right, and you actually have a team dedicated, but really the asset is powering the media business that you're building, or the media tech layer that you want to build. And that's the problem for most of ad tech is signals, right? It's like, where do you get the signals post-cookie, post-ID, right? And there'll be solutions. Sure. But having proprietary data, I'd imagine the Trade Desk pull a lot of money out of the US.
There's another challenge there, Kieran, that the reason why it's not such a crackpot theory is Trade Desk already have a huge engineering and technology team. It takes a lot to keep something like Yahoo Mail going.
Right.
I seem to remember when AOL bought Yahoo, AOL had something like 1,000 engineers globally, and Yahoo had 3,500 in the US. So it takes a lot to keep that asset running. Who could do that and generate it to be and keep it as a functioning product to generate that first party data? Trade Desk is one obvious answer.
Yeah.
So
I question the scale of it, given that Yahoo is obviously certainly not a dominant email provider in the US.
Right.
It certainly is in some markets. Like, it's still very popular in the likes of France, for example. But is it dominant enough for the Trade Desk to go, we can take this on and we can keep an ESP running? Would they for the proprietary data they get from a US perspective?
Well, when you consider a DSP, what is a DSP? It's a dumb connection to a marketplace of inventory that just executes on a sale. How do you make that a more valuable proposition? I mean, Trade Desk do a very good job of making it a valuable proposition. Google have got their own set of challenges with how they're trying to push Flock and the whole GDPR issues around that. So if Universal ID, as Kieran says, is not going to catch on or is going to take too long, how do you generate that level of first-party data that you can create other unique sets of to give your clients that level of satisfaction? You have to buy something that gives you the scale. It's no good buying 20, 30 different companies because it all takes time to integrate that. You buy one big asset like Yahoo Mail and you get a huge amount of data.
Yeah, interesting point. I'm going to move us on because we've spent probably far too much time chatting.
What about all the other assets? We could spend a whole show on this.
Which is why I'm moving us on, because otherwise it's never going to end. And we've got exciting TV stuff to talk about.
I love TV. So,
good. Yes, you love VOD. You don't think linear exists. We're not getting to that. We probably will. So second story of the week is interesting musings from MediaPost, which are, could a broadcast TV network disappear within 5 years? This comes off the back of global CIO of media agency Essence, Adam Gerber, who says that he believes there could be a future where TV networks would get as low as 0.2 primetime ratings 5 years from now. This relates to Nielsen ratings in the US. And if you aren't sure what that actually means, it isn't obvious that 0.2 is incredibly low. 0.2 rating for most of the big networks is disaster zone and would result in TV show cancellations. The best ratings are kind of in the 4+ range. They're normally reserved for the kind of the big scripted shows like Modern Family, Big Bang Theory, empire and major sporting events. So there's a big chasm in between where a lot of different types of shows sit and where, depending on what network they on sit. But 0.2 essentially means that a broadcast network cannot run. So with a massive increase in cord cutting and a huge growth in VOD, the incumbent broadcasters are rapidly losing the war and trying to keep audience attention. And the question is, can broadcasters actually afford to keep their linear networks running? It makes me think actually of BBC Three in the UK, which they went full digital a few years ago because they couldn't afford to keep it running as a linear network. And they've had such success from the likes of Fleabag and Normal People, they're actually considering it, bringing it back to terrestrial TV again. But in any case, the point was that BBC couldn't afford to keep BBC Three running. And do you think that the same thing could be happening? Obviously, this is a US story from a US perspective, but do we see this? It could be feasible somewhere like the UK, where there's kind of fewer networks and there is obviously a big rise to BVOD and SVOD and AVOD in this country. In the US in particular, I think the story relates more to local TV networks, of which there are hundreds and thousands, obviously statewide, countywide, in the US that can't afford to run if they're loyal viewers are increasingly going towards SVOD. And as audiences get, as the older audiences start moving more towards away from linear and onto SVOD, do we see the possibility that linear broadcasters could go bust? This again relates to a story we spoke about a few weeks ago, which is the big networks in the US are trying to encourage the marketers to shift their investment from linear into CTV. So again, that's another kind of theory to help fuel this notion that the potentially broadcast linear is dead and could a TV network go bust? Interested in your general thoughts on this. Alex, I'm going to start with you on this one.
I mean, do we think TV companies are going to go bust or fall by the wayside? I think that's natural in any business ecosystem. There's always a survival of the fittest. Do we think the major ones are going to be in trouble in the next 5 years? I don't think so. Possibly longer than that, but I don't think so in the next 5 years. They've got enough innovation going on. And just looking at our own research that we recently conducted on CTV, we know that 14% of the UK consumers have cut the cord. We know there's another 17% plan to do so over the next 12 months, as in 2021. 58% have no intention. So if you look at it from an ecosystem point of view, I think it goes back to what I just said. There's always a survival of the fittest, but are the big boys going to be in trouble? I don't think so. They have enough about them on how to innovate and how to push, and CTV's given them a new lease of life. If you look at your example around the BBC, that's an interesting one, actually, because why would you need to bring BBC Three back as a terrestrial channel? You've got iPlayer. iPlayer is easily one of the most popular devices in the UK. You can watch it. You don't have to use it as video on demand or programming on demand. You can use it on your live situation as well. So why would you go to the expense of bringing back an outdated piece of technology when you can invest that money into creating the actual content that the consumers want and differentiated content as well that is more reflective of our current stage of consumption, and people want that variety.
You're absolutely right. The demand is there. And the flip of that, of course, is the likes of Channel 4, who are trying to do the opposite and trying to, I think it's, they want by 2025, 40% of their revenue to come from digital services and monetization from all four. So you kind of see the other, that going the other way, but you probably expect that more from Channel 4 than you might do the BBC. But yeah, you make an interesting point. Why would they do it? Because the demand is clearly there for linear in some capacity. Kieran, you always have strong views on linear as a strong advocate of CTV and VOD. So what do you think about this?
I think there's so many problems with the traditional broadcast model that is going to affect them going forward, right? So the idea of event-based TV is kind of dying at that, right? It's still holding itself, I guess. The stats are not showing it. Probably the younger population are probably watching more video on demand and CTV and, tipping in when they need to. I guess that's why a lot of the broadcasters are overpaying for sporting rights, because it's event-based TV. But what stage does that become untenable and unprofitable or even profitable to keep paying over the odds for sporting events? Because actual sporting events are going to have their own problem. A lot of the kids coming up are not really as engaged in the Premier League or, baseball or whatever. There's a couple of sports that have done a great job of engaging the next generation, like NBA, because they've gone all in on crypto and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of the celebrities, celebrity players are celebrities in their own right in the US. A lot of the NBA guys are kind of like next gen sort of social media stars. But it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting themes there. Can a broadcaster continue the model they've had like into the next decade?
Well, let's not forget, it comes down to content, right? If they've got the right content, let's face it, Line of Duty, final episode, as bad an ending as it was, still attracted 12.8 million viewers. There are jewels in their repertoire, and if they are smart about how they package their content up, they can still have a place in the ecosystem. However, the smarter ones are already transitioning to provide that variety of content on the digital platforms and that traditional content on the linear platforms.
There's another story as well. I mean, there was the TV up front in the US, which is obviously a very predominantly US event. But advertisers are moaning, and I read this on Ad Exchange, that the advertisers are annoyed that they're paying more in terms of CPMs when the audiences are decreasing, right? So that's my point. It's a lot of the business they have, broadcasts, is ad-driven, right? It's ad revenue, right? Yeah. And if their traditional linear audiences are decreasing, they need to find that money somewhere. And I think, like, it's rethinking the model, right? I agree with you. Like, content's everything. Production, the production piece could be interesting. But do the broadcasters rethink about how they distribute their content and sign deals with the likes of Netflix and them globally to redistribute their content, which many independents have done. So does that affect what a broadcast looks like going forward? It's a very interesting question, because I'm sure that smarter people than me are looking at these companies and thinking, can these companies survive, you know, that cord cutting? Does their model work in the next decade, particularly as sporting events? They're overpaying for that, but the audience are not following the money. You know what I mean? Like, you're paying billions for NFL or Premier League, but yet the audience is not watching those sports. But
they are watching it online. They are watching it through a digital platform. And that's where they're also cutting their costs and keeping their margin high. Mm. So to be investing in these sporting events isn't overpaying. I agree with you. But is it a smart play? Yes, of course it is, because the consumers, whether you're a millennial or not, you're still going to be following your brother, your sister, your father, your grandparents, and what sporting team they follow, and the vast majority are. So you will consume it. You'll just consume it via a different channel. So securing the sporting events and then engaging with them through their digital solutions is actually quite a smart play. It's just whether or not that is sustainable going forwards when you're still carrying the legacy linear cost as well. Mm. So that's why I think the BBC have got a very smart play with the iPlayer. In the US, they've been very quick to embrace the likes of CTV and their own digital platforms. And let's not forget, if you have, given the last 15 months with the pandemic, since the likes of Netflix lose around 20% of market share, but have less than 1% churn. Whereas Hulu's got something like 8 to 10% churn. Now, it doesn't sound a lot in reality, but look, less than 1% means little or no churn. Now, market share has dropped because a huge amount of increased competition into that whole area and that whole digital consumption marketplace. But in the SVOD marketplace, they are holding firm. Mm. So not only do they have the brand loyalty, they have a proven subscription business model that seems to be accepted globally. Nobody's really cancelling their subscription. They're just, as the market grows bigger, what we're finding is they're settling. It's like watching sediment settle in a bottle of wine. They're settling in at around about 31, 32% market share, down from 50. But no churn. That's a solid business model as we move forwards.
I'm going to move us to the third story, and Alex has stolen my thunder on the majority of stats I had to share with you all. So, thank you, Alex, for that. But this ties in really well with the previous story, as Alex has already segued into. And it's broadly that the disruption created in the SVOD market, in the US in particular, and the, quote, staggering disruption created by Disney Plus when it launched in the US in November 2019. So as a result of Disney Plus launching, total number of subscriptions, i.e. everybody that subscribes to something, some kind of SVOD in the US, grew by 24% year on year in Q1 2021. Let's remember, this is pre-pandemic. This wasn't because people were desperate for content and didn't know what to do. This was just, this was a normal month. The world seemed normal and fine. Who knew what was going to happen 4 months later? But it's a 24% increase in total US SVOD subscriptions. And numbers also rose, not insignificant, 6% when Paramount Plus and Discovery Plus launched at the back end of 2020 as well. This is according to research by Antenna. So alongside this, Netflix obviously recently posted their earnings, and they have seen, as Alex mentioned, a drop in market share. So they're down 19% from 50% to 31%. But as Alex also rightfully said, yes, their market share has dropped, and we can expect that due to increased competition, but their churn rate is extremely low versus the likes of Hulu, and Hulu is number two in the US market. And what's interesting now is the likes of HBO Now, which is now HBO Max, Showtime, Stars and CBS, All Access, which is now Paramount Plus. They've all had to scale up very rapidly to get the upper hand against the emerging challenges such as Disney Plus. And it's proved very, very challenging to the cable satellite distributors like Cox, Comcast, DirecTV, et cetera. So with the US's top providers losing 5.9% of their collective subscribers in the last 2 years. So they're losing share. The likes of Disney Plus are taking brand new share that didn't exist before, and also taking share from other SVOD, SVOD companies. How do you think the SVOD industry is going to level out? Now, obviously, the US is an incredibly different beast from the rest of the world. And we say this every time we talk about CTV and VOD in general. The US, because of its cable nature and because of the fact they have these skinny bundles, and before VOD existed, it was common for people to spend upwards of $200 on cable TV anyway. They had to rent their set-top boxes. So they're moving their budget into these different skinny bundles, and to the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime, everybody else, is kind of not uncommon. But where do you see it leveling out? And do you think that the likes of Disney Plus, unless they can keep up with the content creation that Netflix can, are they going to suffer a large churn as well? Alex, I'm going to come back to you on this one because you've already been chatting about it from the SVOD perspective anyway.
I'll be on the naughty step, sorry.
You will be, absolutely.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. Just staggering numbers from Disney Plus. But then when you figure their back catalogue, when you figure that they then were smart enough to buy Lucas Entertainment, when you figure that they then have the Marvel franchise as well, they have the ability, they're the gift that keeps on giving. You know, you've got the traditional Disney films, which are always going to be a gift to parents, no matter where in the world. And then you've got the film franchises that are coming out of Lucas, the Star Wars franchise, which is perennial. And then the Marvels. So I think that what will happen is consumers will look at this and it's already beginning to happen. Again, referring to the CTV research that we did, you got around a third of the consumers are turning around and saying, actually, I've got too many subscriptions and I need to trim them down. And they plan to in the next 12 months. So what does that mean? That means that consumers are going to look at, what do I watch most often? Where am I getting the best most consistent delivery of content I want to watch? You have to factor into that thinking process, they're going to keep Disney. And then it comes down to Netflix or Amazon. Now, if you look at your experience in those two platforms, probably Netflix have the most variety from an international point of view, because let's face it, it's very easy to take US content into the UK and build a business. What's not so easy is then to take that content and have the same level of success with consumers into markets like France, Italy, Spain, Germany, and the Scandinavian markets, where you would need to have a certain amount of investment in content creation from those markets. And if you go on and watch those programs, you've only got to, it's not reinventing the wheel here. Look at how popular Korean drama is. It's sold everywhere over the world, and people will watch it, and they'll take the subtitles. Pretty much the same with the localized content that Netflix are putting out. I think that I'm not saying it's going to be a two-horse race, but I think that there is going to be, when you look at the rationalization of the EdForce, the SVOD providers, I think it's safe to say that Disney and Netflix are pretty are pretty much nailed on to keep the consumers.
Interesting. And so I've got another question for you about what this means from a marketer perspective. So as a consumer, and like I've said, like we've said before, the US is a very, very different market. And particularly when it comes to relationship with advertising, and in particular TV advertising, where there are what feels like thousands of ads per episode of anything. It's a similar case in Australia as well. But what a consumer's been used to in the US is paying a lot of money for cable, but also as part of that value exchange, also getting a ton of ads. They're now getting more and more used to the idea that by paying a smaller amount for a certain piece of content that is potentially ad-free, they're not expecting to see ads when they're going down these different SVOD routes. So will it change the relationship and the nature of advertising fundamentally as consumers become more SVOD focused? And when doing SVOD, they expect SVOD to be ad-free in some ways. And in the US, there obviously are SVOD services out there that do provide ads, or they provide different tiers of what you can and can't buy. But do you think that will become harder for marketers as the TV industry becomes more and more fragmented with all these different SVOD providers, and also as consumers change the way that they their relationship with advertising more fundamentally? How do you see that potentially playing out?
There's no doubt AVOD's on the rise. What the last 15 months have shown us is it's accelerated consumer engagement with digital channels. It's accelerated consumer engagement with their consumption via advanced TV platforms and their use of apps through those TV platforms. And it's also brought into, as we just discussed, sharp focus of if I'm paying five different SVOD subscriptions a month, how many am I actually really using consistently and getting value from? What that really is going to do is, as I said, they'll cut down the number of SVOD subscriptions and they'll increase their consumption on the AVOD-funded platforms as well. And that also, from the UK point of view, and to some extent globally, will bring into sharp focus iPlayer for BBC as well. So they're sitting on a winning ticket there. So what does it, to answer your question, it means that I think we'll see a rationalisation of subscription-based models for the consumer as a whole. And we'll continue to see the rise of AVOD models, and those who have the best content or invest in the best content, whether it's locally created or internationally sourced content, are the ones that will be able to drive the best value for marketeers, because they'll have the most audience. And that's what it will come down to, is how much you can provide or transfer the old reach and frequency model from TV into the consumption of video content on.
Very interesting. Kieran, what are your thoughts on this?
I think Alex has probably summed it up pretty well. I think he's right about the two or three subscription-based channels. I, for one, would not be dumping Netflix. Netflix seemed to have figured out that I like anime. I've been watching a ton of anime. It's actually, some of the stuff in Netflix anime is absolutely brilliant. There's one about a black samurai warrior, which is just off the charts how good it is. So they're top, like Netflix means Disney's using its IP really aggressively. And I think that gives them such a huge advantage in terms of like capturing the spot of the market. But Netflix for me is just on a different level in terms of their AI to figure out what people's specific tastes are. There's always something in there to watch. I mean, they've got a bunch of shows coming up now that I want to watch. I was like going, holy shit, like these are shows. And when I go on to Amazon, it's maybe hit and miss. There's a lot of like formulaic stuff. I know they've got the Lord of the Rings spin-off. And I'll keep Amazon Prime because it helps lessen my Amazon costs, right? So those three will always do well because of those reasons, right? Then it's the also-rans, right? It's like, what do you pay for on top of that, right? Very little. Outside the US, anyway, I can't see anybody going outside those three channels, right? So then it becomes a case of, do you pay for Now TV? I'm kind of paying for Now TV and BT Sports, but I'm going to drop both of them probably at the end of the year and just pay as you go, as opposed to like ongoing. So the golf is on, or, you know, or maybe the rugby or the soccer or whatever, I'll purchase a weekend pass. And I think they've realized a lot of people that they've upped the price in that. Now, to Alex's point, what happens to the AVOD market? Like, none of those guys are going to run ads, right? Because we're not paying for ads. So the AVOD market gets interesting. Is that where the broadcasters come in and fill that gap, right? Because they're all ad-funded. So moving that across to become that AVOD model. And you've got all these kind of like companies like Tubai and Pluto. And it's just, you know, generally shit content on there. Like, you know, it's kind of the third rate detective shows that nobody watches. And you watch it more for comedy than
serious. Well, it's old as well, right? It's back catalogue content.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that the broadcasts could literally eat up that AVOD market. And they should, right?
Yeah.
Transition could be difficult because, as you say, the ad loads won't be as many. But you can certainly command bigger CPMs because the supply will be removed, right? Limited, right? So I think that's where we're going, I think. I think the AVOD market is literally going to be the broadcasters moving back into that space. That's my own sentiment. I think that they'll fill that gap. So you're talking...
It's also likely to be more accurate than current TV measurement.
100%.
Absolutely.
So the marketer's dream, right? It's the marketer's dream.
Maybe
like,
some of those...
How do I move my TV budget? Well, we're providing you a more accurate, greater clarity, targeted solution. Done. Thanks.
Exactly. And maybe some of those smaller channels like Channel 5 and Channel 4 just take the plunge and go all in on our AVOD and say, look, it's not in our interest to run a linear infrastructure because it costs too much, right? And those channels tend to have probably skewed towards a younger audience anyway because they're kind of like a little bit more out there. So Channel 5 is more
in
about...
In today's world, unless you are a legacy old school TV house, linear TV house, why would you engage on a linear platform? You don't need to. There is so much volume through digital platforms and through the use of rising popularity of 5G, that if you want to scale quickly and capture a rapidly growing, intelligent, affluent audience, you would go the digital route. And as Kieran says, I think a lot of the traditional guys will realize they have to go heavy on the AVOD side of the equation because they're just not going to be able to compete with Netflix and Disney.
Why would you want to? I mean, that's a scale game on a level that you cannot compete with. Maybe like a different language, like a Spanish language entity that's global could do that or something like that. But I just think that even BritBox to me is a losing battle. I was like, you know, but the interesting thing about AVOD is you could get all those long tail satellite channels pivoting into AVOD, like the Man United fan TV or Arsenal fan TV. And that's where you're going to start.
I don't think those two will scale.
Well, but you have those niche players, right, that could command a couple of million people, right, if that even exists. And they could be all ad-funded, right? So you ask where the growth in AVOD would come from. I just don't think it's going to come from Pluto TV and all that kind of, you know, I wouldn't call it garbage because it's unfair to say that, but lower down the feeding chain.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be, you know, the explosion in AVOD will come. I think people will look for alternatives. They're not going to pay 10, like it's, as you said, Lindsay, it's just not in our DNA. I don't mind paying Disney Plus. I don't mind paying Netflix because I actually think I'm getting value, right? It's almost like going to the cinema, you know, the recent...
Well, Netflix is proven. Netflix is proven. If you got through the last 15 months of the pandemic and Netflix have had less than 1% churn, that's a proven model and it isn't going to change going forward.
And they're not going to...
Disney, as I said, have such a strong catalogue. And they have so many production studios that they can churn out content, brand new content. That's the hook, plus the back catalogue of children's content. They're gonna own that space. It's between those two who the kings of SVOD are going to be.
Yeah.
Mm. It really is now who's going to take advantage of the AVOD marketplace and mop up those consumers who have said, you know, much in the same like myself and Kieran, two SVOD subscriptions a month are enough.
Yeah, and the other thing as well, then, Alex, is discoverability, right? You know, how do you find these channels as well? Like, that's an area that hasn't really been touched yet, so, yeah.
No. We'll see a level of sophistication on the boxes and how they're monitored. That's why you've seen the rise of OEMs in terms of TVs, because they're able to provide not only HDMI captured data, but also web browser data. So what will happen is there's an acceleration of understanding as to how to capture those marketing dollars that ultimately are sitting there going, do I stick with TV, traditional linear TV, or do I push into the advanced TV marketplace? And the more the digital systems around advanced TV clean up their act around the targeting, the verification process, the more that money will shift. And you'll find a lot more, from an agency world, you'll find a lot more traditional TV planner buyers will be shifting across to the digital teams.
Yeah, very good point. We are running out of time because we've spent so long talking about those actually very interesting things. But I wanted to move on to the second part of the podcast, which, Alex, we get to find out what it is that you guys are focusing on at the moment, what's happening at Unruly, and what the most important things for you are, where your direction's heading at this time.
Yeah, it's kind of a good segue based on what we're talking, actually. Unruly's gone through a lot of growth and change over the last 15 months since the acquisition by Tremor International. We are now multi-format video delivery, pure omni-channel. We have a full tech stack in that we have an SSP, a DSP, and a DMP. And really what the future holds for us is bringing that multi-channel, multi-video format solution to our clients on the international stage. In the US, as you alluded to earlier on, it happens very quickly in the US because of the scale, because of the way the nature of how marketing reacts in there. So CTV is very important for us. We'll also be looking at our own data solutions and increasing our relationships with data partners in order to satisfy our international clients. In the US, that solution is already pretty robust. We already have our own data solution in play in beta in the US. That seems to be proving to be very successful for our clients, and we'll be looking to bring that internationally. So really what we're looking at is trying to get our clients to understand that Unruly, as part of the bigger Tremor International group, has a larger story to tell. It's about scale, it's about multi-video solutions and formats, and it's also about being able to help our clients transition into the advanced TV marketplace. And by that, I mean looking at CTV solutions and OTT app solutions.
And how are you able to go on that journey with your clients and get them to look at the multi-video options that actually exist out there and start the foray into likes of OTT and CTV?
Really, it's a lot of education. It's a lot of which is a bit challenging when you're working through the medium of video calls. It's much easier in a personal environment where you can have a more personalized experience. But it's really around education on what CTV options are available. And just because you are dealing directly with a mainstream media owner, it doesn't mean you're capturing all the audience or the entire audience that's consuming their content. Because, of course, you have to look at the distribution partners. And each of the distribution partners have their own way of attracting consumers. For example, just because you're dealing directly, if we relate this back to the US, just because you're dealing directly with NBC doesn't mean to say you're getting all of NBC's audience. You're getting NBC that work directly with NBC. But then you have the as Kieran alluded to, the myriad of platforms like Pluto, like Roku, and all these other guys that also have the NBC app on their platforms and are also attracting an audience. So it's trying to get a traditional strategy team to understand that there are several ways to capture the audience if you particularly like certain content. So, yeah, there's a lot of education going on, and it's a lot of... a lot of hand-holding, and it's a lot of trying to work together to develop a standard and a system that everyone can buy into.
And your role is international, and you yourself have lived all over the world as well. How do you find that conversation changes, or does it change from a market-by-market basis, or for clients who you're trying to have the conversation with that operate within multiple markets?
Yeah, that's a good one. The large MNCs in themselves are finding the challenge. So CTV and the whole advanced TV ecosystem has raced out of the blocks in the US, and the UK is hot on the heels. Then you've got certain other markets within Europe who are desperate to know more and understand more, but don't necessarily have the same volumes or the same intent from the advertisers to drive that education. Then when you move to the international markets over in Asia Pacific, you've got Australia, who are very much hot out the blocks. And because it's kind of like a closed ecosystem, they're not too far behind the US and the UK. Similarly with Japan, and then in between, the likes of Southeast Asia and Korea and Taiwan are very similar to Europe. They understand that it's an emerging medium, but they still tend to be looking at how and what it can deliver. and doing a lot of research and analysis around the pricing. So it's interesting. It's interesting in that even though video is a proven medium and is growing at scale globally, there's still quite a lot of markets who are in the wait and see mode.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but it's really fascinating to have that conversation with you about what's happening with the multi video space and the OTT and CTV space. But I have to say, thank you very much for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kieran.
My pleasure. Great to see you again.
Thanks, Lindsay. Likewise. Thanks, Alex. Good to see you.
Thank you. And this has been Mad Tech Podcast.